Welcome to episode number 341 of the Family Podcast Network. Today we're going to have special guest David Rue, who's going to come on to talk to us a little bit about the magic of a good night's sleep. Let me tell you guys, David is going to take this really deep with us. We're going to go into the neurological brain study of what happens when we're asleep and why that's important to our kids. Man, oh man, let me tell you, this has been one of the most favorite interviews I've done in a while. You guys are definitely going to want to stay tuned for that and more.
Welcome to the Family Podcast Network, where we help you work with your tough kids and even those that aren't. Coming to you from Tuscola, Texas, home and headquarters of the Family Podcast Network. Here's your host, Trey Gibson.
Well, hello and welcome to this episode of the Family Podcast Network, helping you work with your tough kids and even those that aren't. It doesn't matter if you're expecting, if you're a brand new mom and dad, or even if you're a longtime seasoned parent, there is always something we can do to take our parenting to the next level. The date today is November the 20th, 2014. It is late middle of the week, Thursday. That's right. You guys are noticing today we're putting out a show a day later than we normally would. The reason for that is that we had actually another interview scheduled to do today that we were going to post out. Unfortunately, due to some conflict of being able to make our schedules align up, David and I actually had this scheduled out for this evening. So I thought, you know, might as well go ahead and record this up with David, and we'll put this out on a Thursday instead of our traditional Wednesday. And let me tell you, after this, I sure glad that I am, or that we did this. Let me tell you, topic for today is going to be absolutely fantastic. We're going to go in a little bit about the understanding of what happens whenever you sleep, and what do we need to know for our kids, and how can we help our kids have the best night's sleep. David is going to tie this together so masterfully that you're going to be, I'd be willing to bet, we all understand the importance of a good night's rest. We always say that. I think that David's going to add some serious emphasis on that, and I'm going to be straight. It made me look at our bedtime ritual, and we are probably going to be implementing here at the Homestead to Gibson some serious stuff. Stay tuned for that in just a minute. Before we get into that, some quick housekeeping. If you guys want to get notified of any of the new episodes that come out here at the Family Podcast Network, simply easy way to do that. Go to thefamilypodcast.com over on the right-hand side. Put your name and your email address into that. When you do, you won't get solicited. You won't get a whole bunch of junk emails. You'll just get notified every time we knock out a new episode here at the Family Podcast Network. Just to make sure that you never miss out on that one show, if you just could have heard, it would have changed everything. Don't forget to go like us over on Facebook. Share this episode over there, or on Twitter and all those different places. We do have accounts in those. We want to get this show out there. You guys can help us do that by just doing a quick share and saying, man, I love this. This was a great show. I also want to say a real quick thank you to our Facebook Like Brigade. Those are the folks out there that are always liking the shows, folks like Connie and Mark. You guys are always knocking those out there. We sure do appreciate you guys. Thank you for that. Guys, if you want to support the show at 30 cents per episode, if you feel like you're getting three dimes at every one of these, consider becoming a member. We will always make these podcasts completely for free. One of the ways that we make this show continue to go on is by the contributions that you guys give as P-Tackers. So consider becoming one of those. Go to thehumanpodcast.com. In the very middle, you'll see where it says become a member. Click on that little bad boy and consider doing that. Also, if you guys have any questions, comments, a topic that you want us to cover, maybe you saw something online, you want to shoot it over to us, lots of ways you can do that. You can always email us, Trey Gibson at thefamilypodcastnetwork.com. You can also use the SpeakPipe app over the right-hand side, or click on the Contact Us page. There's a lot of different ways that you guys can get into us. Or last, you can always call us, pick up your phone, dial 661-PARENT and the number 0. Again, that is 661-PARENT and the number 0. You know, I think I'm going to wrap it up on that right there, because we have a great show, and I want to keep this intro segment as short as possible. So we're going to be, we've got David hang on the line with us. David Rue is a 4-year veteran storyteller and producer of a children's nighttime podcast called Biddy the Duck Podcast. He's also appeared on This Little Parent Stayed Home, the Retro Matcast, the Savvy Homeschool Mom, and the Family Anatomy Podcast. Some of those you guys might recognize as some of the ones we recommend here at the Family Podcast Network. His efforts to promote good sleep through storytelling has earned David critical acclaim from 4- and 5-year-olds around the world. Above all, David finds that his most important role in life is that of a dad. With all of that said, David, great to have you on the show today.
Hi, Trey. How are you?
I tell you what, I am super excited to have you on, David, because you're going to come on to talk to us just a little bit today about kids and getting a good night's sleep. And I tell you, this catches my attention, because David, it seems like if I'm watching the research, because I'm a huge, you know, one of the big things about the Family Podcast Network is that we try to draw in a lot of behavioral science and research that's out there. And it seems like this is one of those fields that it's like we go back and forth, where one time they're saying kids need this many hours of sleep and they shouldn't be in front of a TV. So the next part, it's really not that big of a deal if they're in front of a TV, or we should be reading to them, but they really only need 6 hours. And so I love getting folks on here that really take some time to dip into this. So I sure do appreciate having you on the show. So real quick, before we jump into to talking about sleep today, David, why don't you tell everybody in the audience a little bit about yourself?
Fantastic. Well, first of all, I'm a dad. That's the most important thing that goes on in my daily routine. I've been also a teacher for the past nearly 20 years, and it's a music teacher. So what I've been doing is teaching elementary kids, and this is a small school in Minnesota. And I see every day anywhere from grades kindergarten on up through the seniors in the school. It's a combination where I teach elementary general music and then high school choir and junior high choir. And in part, the research that I've done, well, I say that loosely because I'm the one, whatever I say to you today is just a reflection of a lot of the research that other people have done.
Mm-hmm.
But as a music teacher, it plays big into what I find interesting with sleep and with what the brain does, and specifically how it affects us, and then even more specifically, how it affects the children that we have, either the children we teach or our own children, and what kind of a difference it makes in their next day.
Well, you know, there's no doubt that I can, in a lot of ways, you can determine how well of a day that your kids are going to have the next day. You know, for some of the newer listeners out there who may not know, you know, we just adopted a little kiddo, and she came with some emotional baggage of her own. And, you know, we can tell if we have a good night's sleep that night before, mm-hmm. we have a tendency to at least see fewer of those behaviors that are difficult to work with. Versus when we have a good night's sleep, you know, we have better days. And that goes yes. for kids who don't grow up with emotional stuff as well. This is so valuable and so powerful. So I love that we're getting on here to talk about it. So one of the first questions that I think comes to mind is, and it's the great debate that we have, it seems, when it comes to neuro research and to sleep study type stuff. How much time does the average American adult and kiddo need to be sleeping per night?
Well, as it turns out, when you say what you need, that really does depend on the person. And in a lot of cases, it depends on the age of the person. But you could say as a whole that kids and adults are getting probably about an hour to an hour and a half less than what we need. And certain research has shown that, and I don't know exactly how they determine this, but you can say that since the 1950s, we are averaging about an hour and a half less than what we used to get. Okay. But if you're a child, you could say that you want to get in anywhere. This is up to about age 10 or 11. 10 to 12 hours is fantastic. You know, anywhere in that range is going to do so much good for the young people. But once you get into the teen years, what that starts to show is a little bit lesser sleep is just fine, 9, maybe 10 hours. But what's interesting is that the time frame of the sleep shifts where young kids, you know, you're talking maybe 7-8 o'clock and getting up the next morning around 6 or 7. But for teenagers, that time shift changes into a later sleep cycle where they'll go to bed later, but then they'll also get up later. And this is what becomes a kind of an issue with a lot of the way American schools, and I won't specifically say American, it could be anywhere in the world, but how we structure school to be starting so early, you know, and that really comes into issue. For adults, once you get into your 20s, you're starting to see, again, a little bit of a slowdown in terms of how much sleep you need. You might get by on average of 8 hours. Myself, 8 hours. I tell you, the last time I got 8 hours of sleep, I actually woke up feeling worse, okay?
Yeah.
How much sleep do you think you get?
Oh, my goodness. Because of this very thing right here, because most of my podcasting occurs after we get kids in bed, I bet you're going to be mad at me, but I bet 5 to 6 hours, depending on which day it is.
How much do you think you need?
I would be willing to bet, especially being overweight like I am and how that affects my sleep quality, I would be willing to bet at minimum 8 to probably 9 or 10
really?
Hours. It'd be my guess. That'd be my guess.
Okay. I can find myself, if I get about 6.5, I'm pretty sharp. the next day.
Yeah, if I'm learning to survive off of that. It, but unfortunately, yeah. Folgers gets way too much of my money.
That's true. That's so true. So that's kind of in a nutshell. When you get into adulthood, like you and I are finding, you can manage off of certain hours of sleep, and it, again, it depends on the person, it depends on the individual. But what we say is an average is about 8 hours of sleep.
You know, I remember I just saw an article that was put out the other day by Purdue or somebody. It was a fantastically done study, but what they were actually looking to see the weight studies that was happening in the increased obesity in America.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was included in there, and I've seen this on several sleep research over the last 10, 15 years, that the amount of sleep that we get can also dictate that. But what they actually found was that was a semi-correlative. It wasn't completely a one-to-one correlation, a connection between the two. What they actually found was that as the longer that we've gone since they started the research in the 1940s, and they compared it all the way up until I think 2009, I think is what it was. But what they found was that weights were also continuing to go up, but so were our bedtimes beginning to stretch later and later. And there's a lot of different stuff that they pulled into potential implications for that. You know, of course, you start looking into the 1930s and 1940s, electricity was much more rare. And so when things got dark, it was dark. And so they said, you know, they talked about chemical releases in the brain that happened when that, but they also linked that to things like, you know, what is the thing that I do when I crawl into bed? I pull my iPad out real quick and surf, check my internet. Oh, I got to get my Facebook in there real quick, right? And they talked about the light, you know, how the light can affect you, et cetera. And so I find this stuff really interesting.
Yeah, this is all the kind of stuff that I will be talking about, and everything that you mentioned in there has not only a chemical reaction, but also a sort of cognitive reaction to light, specifically, as you said, and how we've changed our sleeping patterns. Depending on how many hours we work a day, a lot of us now work more than the average person would have before, but also just the simple presence of light. And the chemical reactions and the cognitive reactions that happen to that. So what you're describing, right on.
Fascinating. So, you know, we've kind of been hitting a little bit on the neurology, the brain piece of all of this and sleep. What exactly is happening in the brain when we are asleep?
That's a great question. You know, let me set it up this way. I'm going to kind of divide it into two camps. One will be what's happening cognitively with, you know, the sort of electronic activity. Mm-hmm. And then the other half is going to be with the physiological. And I think it's a good place to start with what's happening physiologically with your brain. And I'm going to start at about the moment when we start to fall asleep, because there's a lot that the brain depends on and does during the day. Each of us uses our brain in ways that we know and ways that we don't. You know, there's the cognitive decisions that we make. And then there's the other elements that happen that we're not aware of course, like your heartbeat or when you're breathing. But everything that you do during the day and everything that your brain does takes up energy. And when you look at the brain and its mass and you compare that to the rest of the body, the brain consists of only 4% of your entire body mass. And if a person takes their two hands and puts them together at the wrists, then you curl your fingers under and then put the two hands together, that's about the exact same size as the human brain. And what's interesting is the two halves, as you can see, if you're holding your wrists together with your hands curled up, that center part where your wrists are, that's the only place in which your brain really fuses together. And that's called the corpus callosum. That's a place where about 300 million neurons and nerves interchange between the left and the right half of the brain.
If anybody's wondering out there, yes, I do have my hands in this shape right now.
You know, years ago I got an email. It was a junk email that said 9 out of 10 people who read this email will try to put their elbow to their ear and find out that they can't. And I've not yet done it, so I'm still that 10th person. Anyway, so with the brain having 4% of the body mass, it produces a requirement of energy that is 25% of the entire energy that we use as humans in the day.
Fascinating.
So this is a huge discrepancy. You've got a 4% mass organ taking up 25% of all the energy we require. Throughout the entire body system, all the cells and everything that uses energy, the organs, they have a very elegant way of taking that energy and then releasing the necessary byproduct, which is waste. Everything that we do, anything that requires energy produces waste, A car takes in gas, produces exhaust. A baby takes in food, produces diapers. Everything takes energy, produces waste. And so what the body does is it uses a system of the lymph nodes, lymphatic system. And throughout the body, from about your jawline down, you know, you go to the doctor, and one of the first things they do if you're sick is they reach under your neck and they try to feel for the lymph nodes there. But what's interesting is the brain has no such lymphatic system. There's nothing in the brain specific that is used to take this 25% energy and turn it into the waste and get rid of it. And it's really been recently that they've been understanding, and there's a few key specific people out there who have been doing some fantastic research on this. It's only been recently that they've been able to figure out how the brain does this, because if you can imagine, in order to understand how the brain does what it does physiologically, you have to be able to open it up and look at it while it's alive.
Well, that's pretty easy, right?
Right, we have a necessary problem here then, don't we? I mean, even if it's a lab animal, or, you know, specifically, that's what they would do. But this has been a bridge that they have been unable to cross. But with imaging now that we see, computer imaging, where they can go into and almost literally slice into certain regions of the brain with computer imaging in live animals, some very clever things have been done to find out what's actually happening. To get into the matter of it, your brain sits in a bath of liquid. It's a clear liquid called the cerebrospinal fluid. And this is the stuff that goes through your spine, goes around the cortex of the brain and lines your brain as a sort of shock absorber. So that when you get a bang or your child like falls down and hits the banister, its brain is kept safe. Your brain, my brain is kept safe by this layer of liquid that lines between the brain and the inside of the skull. But this cerebrospinal fluid really does a lot more than that. And this is what we're finding out, that during sleep is what's happening. As soon as you're starting to fall asleep or you're getting sleepy, there's a region called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And these are directly, these are placed directly above, I'll say it again, it almost sounds like out of Mary Poppins, but it's the suprachiasmatic nuclei, extrahalitosis, right? Well, this region is right above the eyes, and it has a real close connection to the optic nerves and what kind of light you're taking in.
Interesting.
When the ambient light starts to dim, this is like daylight. And this is what you mentioned earlier. As our eyes and our bodies start to sense that the daylight is dimming, that signal gets sent to the region of the suprachiasmatic nucleus. There's two of them, the nuclei. And that region is where we see what you may be familiar with, the circadian rhythms, that internal body clock that tells you now is the right time for sleep, now is the right time to be up. This area does a little more than that. It helps regulate body temperature, and it helps regulate, you know, other items that are vital to kind of the timing of your body's internal clock. But once this ambient light starts dimming, and up here it starts happening now about 4:30 or 5 o'clock, once it starts happening, it sends a signal to an area at the very base of our brains, right near the spinal cord. And this is the pineal gland. And this is important because the pineal gland is responsible for releasing melatonin. And melatonin is something that we may be familiar with in terms of some people use it as a sleep aid.
Yeah, right.
And it's a very natural thing because it isn't a chemical that the body is foreign to. So this is a natural chemical that your body reacts to. And that release of melatonin, once that happens, that's when you start to see the effects of being sleepy, the rubbing of the eyes, the yawning. Once this begins happening, your brain physiologically starts to take you down into that sleep place. And during sleep, this is where the research becomes pretty critical. The more recent research, we used to think that the brain simply shut down. You know, you could see that the brain waves, or you might imagine that your brain waves would start to just kind of chill out. That along with the rest of the body, we start to see that the brain does the same thing. But quite the opposite is happening. And I think at this point, I might kind of blend the two ideas of the physical and the cognitive area of what's happening. But with the physical part, just to finish with this, they're finding that the blood vessels, the arteries that flow blood into, these, of course, are the arteries supply the oxygen through the blood into all the regions of the brain, the deepest parts of the brain. They're finding out that at night, the arteries and the veins, which lead the deoxygenated blood out, they start to constrict. They start to thin out. They start to become smaller, more narrow. And as this happens, the tissue, all the internal tissue of the brain, is now a little more accessible. And the cerebrospinal fluid, which I mentioned earlier, what it starts to do is it starts to dive down deep into the regions of the brain, the deepest parts. And like a broom, it starts to sweep out the chemicals and the waste, which I talked about, and the proteins. It starts to sweep these out. And then, in a sense, it starts to percolate that fluid back out from the center, back out through the layers of the brain, returning then to that outer cerebral fluid, that region that surrounds the brain. And then from there, the waste just leaves that area through the spinal cord or through its exit out into the blood, and then is released back out of the body where it's dealt with. But when I mentioned before that there were no lymph nodes, this is how the brain takes care of its waste. It takes care of it by piggybacking. And this is so, to me, is so elegant. It piggybacks. It almost, as it was described by this, and I'm going to say his name, Jeff Iliff, who was a researcher at Rochester, I think in New York. And this was done about 3 years ago. He was able to image by taking and inking cerebrospinal fluid and watching what it does. And what it actually does is it follows the channels. It almost like a sleeve goes around the arteries in order to get into the deepest parts of the brain, then passes away from the arteries through the tissue, transfers itself, this fluid, transfers itself to the veins that lead itself back out. And this is something that they could never have discovered without this sort of technology. And this is what happens. This doesn't happen during the day. The only time this happens, you can guess it, is at night.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. But in a sense, this makes so much sense. If you can imagine with any of us who have kids, are you going to clean the living room floor at 2 p.m. when the kids are still
no,
playing?
There is no possible way.
You're going to just clean it up again.
An You're exercise going to be and futility, yeah.
Bingo. When is the time that we all do this? Well, if we have the kids doing it, it's at night. If the kids go to bed, well, then we do it at night. When everyone's asleep, motion has ceased, we can take care of these things. And that's the same thing the brain does and has done for however many years you want to say it's been around. So that's the physiological aspect of what's happening. And what it speaks to is the need for sleep. And not only just, we used to say quality sleep, but in a way, you know, it is quantity as well. Hmm. And I think any of us understand the effects of what happens when we don't get enough sleep. You start to your thinking trips.
Yeah.
Okay. Your ability to connect things, your ability to remember. Okay. Short-term memory starts to really fail. All of these things that we could associate with a lack of sleep, you can also say, well, it's the same thing about your floor, your living room floor, when the kids go to bed. If you don't pick up those toys, if you don't have a moment or a time when you say time to just hit reset and get rid of all that stuff, it collects. And what do you start doing? You start tripping over yourself. You start tripping over the toys. The clutter happens. You become less, the kids play with a lot less joy, you know? So the same thing happens to us.
Yeah.
And our brains have a hard time. Actually, it doesn't even take care of the job of eliminating the waste during the day. It is specifically at night. Now, you mentioned earlier the other results of, you know, potential weight gain. and of mood swings. Well, these are also a part of what happens when our brain does not get the chance to fully eliminate all of this waste. And, you know, certain other physiological things happen. We crave the sugars, you know, because the sugars are that bam, that's that instant energy.
Yeah.
And our brain is starting to clog itself up, and it needs that energy to keep on going, but it needs it in the form of something quick. You know, I have children, and, you know, there's that, just like yourself, there's only certain things you can do once the kids have gone to bed. And as a result, we as parents, we don't get the sleep we need. But again, just to kind of end with the physiological, that's what's happening. And with any of the results from the next day, you know, they're not good. But this is where the cognitive part of it, to me, this is equally as fascinating. And I became interested in this because I teach lessons after school. I teach, you know, the music classes during the day, but then in the evenings, in the afternoons, I teach private lessons, piano, guitar, drums, bass. And I started to see patterns in how kids were learning certain songs. And I think specifically with piano, because with piano, what we're doing is we're talking about 10 different digits. And we're trying to communicate, our brain is trying to communicate with these 10 different digits. And each of them has a different level of importance to our brain. If you could draw a picture of what your fingers are in terms of importance, your index finger, if you're right-handed, would probably be the largest finger. We use it for so many things. Likewise, your thumb. The finger that the hand, or the finger that the brain knows the least and is least able to control, in other words, it has the fewest pathways to, the fewest connections to, is going to be your non-dominant hand and the ring finger. So I'm right-handed. Most people are. You right-handed?
I am.
Okay. It will be the ring finger in the non-dominant hand. And that's the one that when I'm playing scores, when I'm looking at students trying to learn pieces of music, you can just watch which finger they're going to have a problem using. And then which brain or which finger the brain defaults to. If the brain is trying to send a signal to the ring finger, sometimes it just goes to the point finger because it's, you know, its pathway is more direct. So I started to look at this, and I started to wonder what is actually happening in the brain as a musician myself, these young kids who I'm teaching. And I heard an interview that was done with a musician, and she was a drummer. And she explained that she was trying to work on this piece of music, and it was late in the afternoon, evening rather. And it was a complicated piece. It was new. And for 2 hours, she was trying to get this rhythm, this riff down on the drums. And it wasn't working. She got frustrated, threw the sticks down, and went to bed. Lo and behold, she got up the next day, sat down at the drums nearly immediately. And what do you think happened?
Yeah, she got it.
She played it completely as she had wanted to.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So what's happening? Well, you know, when I say the hocus pocus focus, the magic of a good night's sleep, think back when you were in high school, sometimes teachers would say to you, do you expect to put the book under your bed, under your pillow?
And osmosis. Yeah, osmosis.
Exactly. Through osmosis, absorb that information. In a way, in a sense, yes. Sleep has a magical effect, a cognitive effect that, in essence, and I'm going to get to this in a second, we actually problem solve through material, through things, while we're asleep, that during waking moments, we may not be able to do.
Interesting.
As a person is asleep. Now, let me back up. As a person is awake, I like to describe it this way. You take any event that happens during your day, something mundane like tying your shoe, or something fantastic like a really, really good joke. Every one of these things that you do, you experience, turns on, in effect, I won't say it literally, but you can imagine, turns on a little light. Or depending if it's a major event or something that's critical for survival, turns on a very large light. By the end of the day, all these events, big and small, your brain has turned on a myriad of light. And this lady who was talking about the drumming that she was trying to get, at that point in the day, so much light was on inside of her brain that being able to make the necessary connections that she needed to get this correct wasn't really possible. It was because there was so much that the brain had experienced that day. I had an experience with this with a young lady who was, we started a piano piece. If you're familiar with Shrek, uh-huh, I imagine right, most yeah. of the parents out there are. There's that one from the first Shrek, that song by the Cohen, that guy Cohen. It's that Alleluia.
Beautiful song.
Yeah. Well, she is trying to learn this tune, and it's beautiful to play on the piano, and it has a nice flow to it, but there were certain parts that the chord changes. She was having a hard time keeping in tempo the hand movements, the chord changes. And she tried it, and she tried it, and she tried it, and it wasn't working. And everything about that song had gotten kind of to its maximum. Well, the good parts, they were at their best. And the parts that she was having trouble with, they weren't getting any better. And so I suggested to her, I said, look, listen, I heard about this, and I'm going to ask you to try this. I said, you know, go home, play it a little more. But then before you go to bed, do your routine. Do all the things that you typically do, but leave yourself 5 minutes before your head hits the pillow and play this song. Try to work through it just for 5 minutes more. And she did just that. Lo and behold, and I said, and the next day, you get up, get out of bed, play it, and see what happens. But she came back to school that next day, and she had this wild grin on her face, and she couldn't believe it. She said it was like magic, where what she could have done for 2 hours that afternoon and evening didn't yield one bit more, and matter of fact, couldn't have done any better. But by going to sleep, her brain was able to work through the piece, was able to problem solve. If you can imagine, with all these lights going on, for many years and for a long time, we've kind of believed that what happens to the brain is that it, like a master circuit breaker, it just takes all of the light, and at once, when sleep hits, all of those lights just come down. Mm. But what effectively seems to be happening here is that the brain is, you could say the brain is sitting down as soon as you fall asleep, going to the kitchen, going to the refrigerator, making a sandwich, grabbing a soda, and sitting down in a nice comfortable chair, looking then at everything that happened that day. Hmm. And while it's sitting down, it starts to look at all these lights, and it starts to interpret, okay, which of these is important for survival? Or it might say, which of these are mundane, or which of these are unimportant? And one by one, and you have to forgive me, I am not a neuroscientist, and I don't play one on television, okay? But what I'm kind of connecting here is what I've heard other people say, and I'm kind of taking it in my own words and in my own analogy, but it's starting to shut down one by one these lights, and maybe some of them it keeps on. Like, for instance, tying your shoe might be nothing but a little nightlight. But that nightlight needs to stay on so that the next day when you tie your shoe, your brain can recognize it and say, ah, there it is, tying shoe, here we go. But if any one of us has something important to us, like for this young lady was music and is that piano piece, the brain recognizes what's happening and it says, look, okay, here we go. After shutting off all these things, which I don't think I'm going to need the next day, I see that there are three or four lights here that are very important, and they're important to me. And then it starts to say, oh, okay, this was a piece of piano music. And it starts to say, okay, yes, the chord changes. Okay. And then it starts to take those ideas and tie them together. It starts to understand that something was trying to be understood here. And then, because it's the brain, it says, yes, this makes sense to me. And it starts to put it all together. And then you wake up the next morning with all of these extraneous lights off, and only the important ones on. She was able to sit down at the piano and play that same piece of music, but essentially flawlessly. Her mother works at the school as well. And I talked to her about this, and her mother's eyes just opened up. She says, how did this happen? It was like magic. And since then, I have been able to do this on a semi-regular basis. So I feel a student is in a place with the song, and I say, hey, look, play it a little bit, do your routine, play it one more time, go to bed, wake up. And pretty consistently, people are able to say that it does get better. And this is an amazing thing to see. You're actually seeing a real life result of what happens when a person goes to sleep. You're seeing the cognitive result. But what I find most fascinating is that you're seeing this happen without even you doing anything. You know, this is something that the brain is doing on its own. Quite like magic, in fact.
You know, that's first off, that metaphor is absolutely fantastic, David. I absolutely love that in terms of the lights being on. When I did my thesis for my undergraduate degree, one of the things that I pulled out was the effect of memory and sleep. And I was particularly studying how effective is cramming, how effective is the late night cram sessions. And you know, I pulled out all the big material on all the guys who have done memory and neuroscience and went through it. And what I was finding was that cram sessions are very ineffective unless you can try to take the test immediately after the cram, which most kids don't. And so what they found was that whenever we tried to memorize information, if folks were having a hard time memorizing what was going to be on their test, that if they would just go to sleep, then more often than not, what they would find is when the kids would wake up the next day, the material that they could not make stick that night actually entered in. It was flashed across, you know, the neurons, the dendrites, and it was memorized. But for some reason, it could not be recalled. There was something about the chemicals that recall memory that wasn't working. And once they would go to sleep, they could wake up the next morning. And often, in almost all cases, they could either remember it or go through it one more time, and it would come back up. So I find that so fascinating how closely that ties.
Yeah, it is. And what's really neat about this is that it's so, in essence, it's so new. You know, you say these people who are doing this fascinating research are finding out some things that we haven't ever understood, mm-hmm. but we've understood. You know, the very basic things that we could say, you know, you feel, you think more clearly after a good night's sleep. Well, physiologically, we can see why. It's because your brain has had the opportunity to flush out all of these, all of the waste that it collects, you know, and having to do with memory, with emotional, you know, your emotions and what sleep loss does, is incredible as well. So yeah, I think that if, as much as we explore outer space, to be able to now have the ability to explore inner space in a lot of creative ways, I'm telling you, the amazing things that we don't yet know that we are capable of, not just as a human race, so to speak, to be grand about it, but I think on an individual level, and this is where, to me, one of the greatest joys of teaching comes in, is you can show a child or you can show an adult what they're capable of, you know, and what wonderful things it does for self-esteem. And this isn't dependent on who you are as far as where you come from or what you are. You know, the brain is the brain. And when you can get down to it with these individual people, with these musicians, or with any child, and you can say, look, let's show you what your brain can do, you know, let's show you what you are able to do. There are so many benefits that they feel it, they understand it, and they start to believe it. They believe it in themselves. But what does it all come down to in essence? Well, back to sleep. It comes down to that.
So, you know, you've got me thinking about this too. And, you know, if that is some of the most amazing lit review I have ever heard on the sleep effects in brain. So, David, that's absolutely fantastic.
Isn't it? I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, please say this
again. Anything that I'm talking about is done by a lot of research by a lot of people who are a lot smarter than myself, or at least have the opportunity to do these things.
I always tell people the same thing about parenting. I'm kind of a small guy standing on the shoulders of some pretty big giants, but yeah. I get you. Well, man, I tell you, David, this stuff is absolutely phenomenal. And I'm going to say, based off of just the masterful research and understanding of brain, you know, the neurology of all this that you brought, I don't think you're going to have to sell anybody on this idea that this is absolutely imperative. That this is
the only people we're going to have to sell this to are going to be the bosses and the employers who make us set our alarms to get up to get to work on time.
No,
right?
I'm saying business naps is what I'm saying. We should be provided naps.
We're in Europe now, aren't we?
So one of the questions that's coming to my mind then is, what are some of the steps that families can do then before bedtime to help us, you know, get that better sleep that we're talking about?
That's good. Yeah, because you're a family show, I do want to focus on what it means for families to put this routine together. There's anything that I say you can take as an individual Because in essence, it's based on that, so to speak, what individuals need to do. But because of the audience that you have, and I guess in myself, because as a podcaster, what I do when I as I create these shows, which are for bedtime specifically, these nighttime stories, I find that there's a lot of neglect that happens during those moments, during those events before bedtime. Being guilty of it myself, you know, I do find myself at the grocery store after the kids go to bed, and it's not unsurprising to find a mom or a dad with their young one there at the store
in the 11 o'clock hour.
And I'm not going to cast aspersions on that, because as parents, we need to do what we need to do, and you have to get, you know, so, but as far as a family, I think what we're neglecting is the raw material, the value of what's possible by taking those events before bedtime as a family. There's a lot of research out there that suggests, and without question, the benefits of eating together, of having that family meal time, which is something that we at our house is incredibly important, because there's so much conversation that gets taken care of. There's so many things that get worked out. There's so many bonds that get created. Well, this also can happen during bedtime. I use the word routine. I think the proper word here is ritual. I think that is the word ritual sends out a message that what's about to happen is important. Routine suggests this is a task, but
doldrums,
exactly. Ritual, well, that has a much more gilded image to it. And I started to think about, we just went to the movies this past weekend, and it hit me in a way, as I started to think about what happens in a theater. I'm just going to step aside before I get to what I think are some important steps before bedtime. When you go to a theater, the movie theater, a multiplex, I'm going to use that because that's what most of us know now. Although we do have a drive-in theater about 20 miles from where I live now.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
Oh my gosh. And up here in Minnesota, that's rare. I don't know what it's like down in Texas, but you know, a drive-in theater around here is only going to last you about 4 or 5 months. I'm not going to go out there when it's 20 below, right?
No kidding.
So the event, the things that happen in a movie theater, of course you buy your ticket. And once you buy your ticket, if you pay attention to some things here, the movie industry, each individual theater takes some very deliberate steps and getting your senses ready for the movie. If you can imagine, as soon as you start walking in and you're starting to head towards the lobby, and of course you smell the popcorn and you hear it popping, and they do that for a reason, because they need money. And so in order to keep themselves in business, they want you to smell and hear the popcorn. But pay attention in your mind to what's on the floor, the substance on the floor. Is it ever tile? No. It's carpet.
Carpet, yeah.
What's on the walls? Is it a wood paneling? No, it's carpet. The first thing that starts to happen as you enter the theater is your auditory senses start to raise, because the ambient sound is cut down.
It's absorbed. Fascinating.
So that's the first step that starts to happen. And as you start to make your way towards the theater, you go down the hallway, you start to notice that the light becomes more dim, the ambient light specifically.
Yep.
You don't have any ceiling lights. You have wall sconces. And even successively, they may become more dim or more sparse, farther in between they're being placed. Finally, you enter your specific theater. You're almost at a near blackout. You have runway lights, little Tivoli lights that line your pathway. And then as you get into the theater, again, the wall sconces. It's entirely ambient light. And you're watching the commercials, and as soon as you know those end, you'll notice that the sconces in the wall dim a percentage. Then they go to the trailer. The trailers start showing you the movies that are going to be coming up. And then just before your feature presentation, the wall sconces dim to almost a complete 100%. And as the movie begins, the ambient light has faded to black. And all of these little events are the movie industry, and specifically your theater, taking your senses and muting them and heightening them at the same time. And what's the interesting response to to your voice. As the environment quiets, it causes your voice to quiet down, which of course is what they want.
Right.
I mean, who wants anybody talking out loud at a theater?
It happens, so, but yes.
Oh my gosh, Star Wars 3 was absolutely ruined for me by a couple of
yeah, shut up, please.
Couple of knucklehead teenagers behind me. I don't know. They were eating a lot of snacks, I'll tell you. So I think they had a little more going on there than just the Star Wars movie.
What do you mean? Whatever do you mean, David?
So, anyway, all of these things I think are great cues to think about when it comes to bedtime and it comes to the bedtime routine. If we put that same kind of process into the moments leading up to sleep, we're going to find, I think, a lot more success. It's not a blanket. It's not a blanket percentage, but 69% of Americans, you could take at any age, have some kind of sleep. I won't say disorder, but something that's catching them.
Yeah.
You know, you could probably roll into that amount of sleep, but you know, it could also become environment. You know, a parent or a home that doesn't really put a lot of emphasis on when the child goes to sleep. And so the child is just left up to their own whim. And I see this all the time. You know, I can see young people who have those tired eyes that you see. You know, I can even, you can almost pinpoint the kids who sleep with younger kids in their bedroom. You know, sometimes you get a junior high student who sleeps with a 5-year-old.
Sure.
And that affects their sleep and their sleep patterns too. But I think of it as a 5-step process or 5 simple steps you can take to help set a ritual before going to bed. And the first thing I think to do is to do what the movie theaters do, is to soften the sounds. Even if there's activity happening, you know, you've got maybe you're 20 minutes away from starting the bedtime routine, soften the sounds by starting to play somewhere some quiet music or some relaxing music. You know, there's Pandora, there's iHeartRadio. You can kind of start to put on some light piano music or something. And any of these things I suggest, they have an Oprah quantity, quality, which is like, sure. Well, here's the ideal. And then Oprah nods and says, oh, yes, this is what we all should do. But I'm sorry, yeah. Oprah does not live in the real world.
Right.
You know, God bless her. She does a lot for the world. But hell, anyway, you know, she doesn't have children.
Right. Yeah.
I'll just say that.
Right.
You know, I compare Oprah to Jerry Seinfeld. No, Jerry Seinfeld, he's a star out there who has children. And he was on Leno one night. And it was a setup question because Jerry has his jokes he wants to tell. And Leno said, so, you know, tell me about the kids you've got. You know, how many kids you got at home? And Jerry says, you know, at the time, he said, I've had 3 children and the house is crazy. Goes, my gosh, you know, what's that like? And Jerry Seinfeld said, you know, a house with 3 children at times is like running a blender without a lid on top.
Yeah, that's right. You're outnumbered now. 2 parents, 3 kids. You're outnumbered.
The explosion of activity that's so hard to control. Okay, so anyway, soften the sounds. Set that up. Let the ears start to sense that something is about to change. The next thing to do is lessen the lights. And that's what the movie theaters do. They start to take that ambient light. And that's the important part. The light that your eyes sense. In the evening, as the sun goes down, like you mentioned at the very beginning of the show so accurately, we've taken nighttime and extended it by 2 to 3 hours with the incandescent and the fluorescent lights. And now computers, TVs, iPods, tablets, phones, video games, all of these things are taking and putting an incongruity between the biological clock that I mentioned earlier, that circadian rhythm that the brain is ready to do. When it senses the ambient light is dimming, your optical nerves, which cross over right near that suprachiasmatic nuclei, which I talked about, that sends the signal. But what are we doing? We're keeping on the TV. You know, I mean, I'm not suggesting people turn everything off when the light goes down, but
yeah.
You got to understand, or when the sun goes out, but what you got to understand is happening is we need to lessen the lights. Take that time now to get the kids to step away from the computer and all those devices, which I said, because the eyes do react to the light that's coming from those devices. So soften the sounds, lighten the lights, or lessen the lights. And then it's time at this point, part three is for everybody to kind of gather together, do their routines. All right, everybody, let's get your jammies on. Let's brush your teeth. Let's have a snack. And then let's kind of get together. This is that moment that I mentioned is the opportunity for families to have that bonding time again.
Yeah.
So where these things are great for anybody, but when you're a family, this is an opportunity for kids to now notice that, okay, so this is a ritual. Ritual is something that indicates this is important. And when family comes together, what are you saying? Family is important. More specifically to the kids, I am important.
Yeah.
Okay? This is all done without words. This is just the event of bringing everyone together. All right, four. There's two more. Four, it's time to explore the fantastic. This is story time. This is time for you to read your stories. This is time for you to listen to bitty bedtime stories.
Huh? Plug it.
You know, this is even time for you to tell a story.
Yeah.
Make one up. Or even this. Don't underestimate how much kids like hearing about stories of when you were a kid. It gives them placement. It gives them identity with their own past. And it puts a different humanness to you because they're around kids all day.
Yeah.
That's their life, the people and the kids in their age range. So when you bring yourself into a story of their age range, it connects them to you in a way that only stories like that can. Like, for instance, talk about the time that you were walking on the sidewalk, found a piece of grape gum, picked it up, put it in your mouth, and started chewing it. They would love to hear a story such as that. Yeah. This is the time for everybody to kind of explore the fantastic. When I say fantastic, you know, when we read stories at bedtime, they're the whimsical stories. They're the things that kind of disconnect us from reality. And in a sense, start to set that stage for sleep, for dreaming, which is thoroughly disconnected. But these events, obviously, reading a book, telling a story, they kind of wind the brain down and soften that soil, kind of loosen the reality of life. Maybe get rid of those worries that the kids had by focusing them on something that's a little more fantastic or fanciful. You know, this is when the children need to let go of the baggage that they carry with them. Yes, they do. We do, and they do as well. Yeah, theirs is different. You know, theirs is probably the kid who was bullying them on the bus. You know, and those things at this point, the family begins to reassure the child that, hey, whatever happened during the day, you're going to come back to this moment, this time, this place, this setting with me. I'm going to be there with you at the end of the day. What an incredible bond that creates. And then the last part, number five, which is parting. And this is the part where you do your little goodbye kisses or your goodnight kisses or your hugs. Say prayers if that's what you do. Sing a song. These last little bits of the ritual, they really start to get that child into a mode of, end of story, period, end of paragraph. This is it. I'm ready for bed now. So those five simple steps, soften the sounds, lessen the lights, everybody everywhere, do your routines and let's gather together, explore the fantastic, and then parting. And this is where I wish I had a visual aid, because softening the sounds, S, lessening the lights, L, everyone gather together, E, explore the fantastic, E. And parting, P. What does that spell out?
I see what you did there.
Came around the backside, didn't I? So those simple steps, which mimic so much of what the movie theaters do to get us ready to roll the theater, to roll the movie, the same thing we can do to get our children and ourselves ready for that night theater, which is dreaming, you know?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this then, David, because I'm listening to this, and I'm going to be honest. You know, we're guilty of what you'd probably call the cardinal sin of, I mean, we let our kids watch TV to wind down in the evening. And some of that is, at least we've always justified that in our mind, mm-hmm. is that we homeschool our kids. And so we don't have quite the time constraints. We don't have to be up at 6, 6:30 and be up and out the door at 7:30 and drop off. You know, we have six kids. We don't have to drop six kids off in six different places and all that stuff. I mean, the kids get up, and then we start our schooling whenever we're ready to during the day. And so we always justified through that. Now, I'm hearing you say that. Research is suggesting that that's not the best thing to do with your kids, and that probably like things like stories and books are better for winding them down. So tell me a little bit about that. Why is like stories and books better for winding down than like TV would be?
Well, the word that you're – I think the key word in that question is winding down. That's what we're wanting to do. A lot of times I'll say I just need to – I just need to defrag. I need to defragment.
Absolutely,
And that's taking all the events, and I just need to let my brain calm down and to do something idle, something mundane, something interesting to me. If it's – and again, I'm not Oprah, right? So what do I do before I go to bed, right? You know, wish I was Oprah, or at least wish I had her pockets.
Yeah, anyway, no kidding.
But I do the same thing. You know, I'll watch a little TV, or I'll do a little surfing on the internet, maybe watch something on YouTube. But what I'm doing when I'm doing that, I'm recognizing the idea that my brain needs to kind of do something to disconnect from the day, okay? Fortunately for myself, it only takes me about 5 seconds to fall asleep.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could shine a police light in my eyes and I'd probably fall asleep 2 seconds later. But what you're recognizing is that it's that desire to wind down. And the reason that stories, books, the reason that those are ideally better is because it disengages the eyes. It allows the eyes to react in synchronicity with what the biological clock is doing.
Interesting.
Which is saying, hey, dude, time to go to sleep. As your eyes stay open and as your eyes stay stimulated, it keeps battering that biological clock and saying, not yet, not yet, not yet. And in essence, in a way, that's where some of the people or some of the or anybody who may be finding that they're having a hard time falling asleep. Again, I'm not going to suggest that I have the answer to this, but when you start to take those steps, you start to respect what your body is trying to tell you. And in a sense, you want to kind of match those two up. Audiobooks, bedtime stories, and being read to, those are all auditory. And when you combine that with making the visual aspect of lights dimming and then dimming and then dimming, you really start to respect what your body is asking for. And your ears just start to take in what we say is the winding down. You know, we still respect the idea that the brain needs to wind down. None of us would go against that, but it's now the ears that are doing it. And then the ears start to create the images, so to speak, because we rely so much on our eyes to understand the world around us. As soon as you take away the eyes, the mind starts to create the pictures instead of look at the pictures. It starts to use its own imagination to knit together the story being told. And when that happens, you're starting to, like I said earlier, in a way, soften the soil that starts to create the state for dreaming, that sort of relaxed state. And I think that that's probably one of the most important things is that without the eyes as the cue for winding down, your brain isn't looking to say, okay, good, done using my visual ideas. It really just starts to paint them itself. And boy, I mean, that's just a delicious way to start to get yourself ready for sleep. And as for children, I mean, it's just a great way to inspire imagination. It's a great way to develop language as well, because you're relying on, again, the auditory. You're going to necessarily increase vocabulary, the ability to read out loud. And then down the road, you're going to inspire your own children to pass that idea on so that when they have children, that that routine is important to them too, you know. And again, this is the Oprah world. You can't do this every single night. You know, I certainly can't. When you've got a child ranging in ages, you've got a different needs for each one of them, and yeah. they have different needs and different times to go to bed. So I'm fully aware that what these ideas and how they come across, and you know how what kind of application they have in the real world. You know, I mean, I don't think it's right for anybody who doesn't have children to give advice to parents who have children. You know, so let's get out there in the laboratory with the people who actually have children, but. But that's really the key, is so much happens with language during story time and what it develops. And then you just send that child off to sleep and they've heard so much vocabulary, imagination, and all that. And that's just delicious stuff. I love that. That bedtime, that moment is so critical, like the meal, you know. I mean, what are the most biological things that we need as humans? We need water, we need food, we need sleep, we need a sense of belonging and safety. You know, you can go, you're basically looking at Maslow's pyramid.
Maslow, yeah.
Okay. So when you address those base things in a positive way, you're really doing something that's at the root of the human, at the root of what it means to be human. And I think that we neglect that time, bedtime. We neglect that as something that just, okay, time for bed. But there's something that can happen there. There's a bond that can be created. There's something that can be manifested with families that I think is an opportunity that we're missing, you know, with the stories that I do. And I'm sincere about this. This isn't a plug. This isn't as gratuitous as it was earlier. Okay? What I like about the stories that I do, which I think are different from a lot of what other people do with their stories, is that it's not a once upon a time type story. These are little radio, I don't call them radio dramas like they're serial, you know, they're not the Buck Rogers type of thing. But
Metamucil, we got to have a Metamucil commercial in there somewhere.
Yeah.
For Ovaltine. No, Ovaltine. That's what it was.
That's right. Ovaltine, your Dakota ring, right? Yeah, you know, right. Every year, oh my gosh, yeah. Is that a guy flick?
What's one that, what?
A Christmas Story?
It must be. Know. It's one of my personal favorites.
Oh my gosh.
Because, you know, everybody hates the idea of shooting her eye out.
Yeah, exactly. But at the risk of diverging, I'm sorry about that. Anyway, to take that opportunity with these stories, it's a situation where the podcast, you kind of need the parent there because they need to kind of call it up. They need to access it unless the children know exactly where they're going. I like it when there's that environment of the child and the parent there. When they're listening to the stories together, and I do like to make the stories humorous for kids and for adults. From time to time, I'll inject a little bit of humor that will go right over the kids' heads. That kind of keeps the adults, you know, happy. Oh, yeah. About what they're listening to.
Yeah, that's a smart move.
Learned that from Bugs Bunny. But when you're able to kind of challenge the relationship a little bit, and there have been several times and I've done stories where I'll say something to the effect of, all right, parents, listen, look at your child. They're looking at you right now. And you can't underestimate how much that child looking at you right now wants to hear from you, I love you. Mm. And of course, for so many people, that's not something they're able to say.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that, a little bit of uncomfortable aspect of it, because it opens up the atmosphere. It opens up that door of the possibility of, you know, if anybody is uncomfortable with it, maybe that's the door that needs to be opened for them to start talking in that way. Hmm. But beyond the lessons that may involve or relate, there's a lot of laughter. And I like the kids to have that sense, that end of day where there's joy, there's laughter, there's happiness. There's a little bit of silliness mixed in with a lilting and soothing piano solo that ends each story, which kind of brings the vibe back down. But I've been doing these for a while. My kids love hearing these stories, and they usually hear them before I record them. So they're kind of they like the ritual of it, the laughter of it, and that family time, that bond, that bonding moment. And for any family that ever listens to Biddy Bedtime Stories, I'm so grateful that what those stories are and what they mean, that I get to be in that moment with these families. You know, I'm not looking to change the world. I'm not looking for that. But when, as a teacher, you know, I can change one child's life, and you can see it happen. If you can do that with people I don't even know all over the world, if you can make that happen, man, now that's powerful. And that's something I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to do.
Well, I tell you, David, I bet we've got over 300 and something podcast episodes we've done here. I bet out of 300 or some odd, I have asked my wife to listen to maybe 3 or 4 of them. I was like, listen, you need to check this out. Out of all the interviews we've done, all the stuff we put together, there's probably 3 or 4. This is actually going to go one of those ones that when we get done here and we wrap it up and post it out tomorrow, I'm going to ask Corey to come look at this, because we're going to take a serious look at our ritual, our evening ritual, and how we do things, because there's some stuff in here that makes so much sense to me that I think we're going to see if we can put this into practice. And also, real quick to the audience too, I want you to know we will have some links to these places. How do we find David's podcast and stuff like that? We're gonna include those links in the show notes. But I'll tell you real quick before we wrap it up today, David, when you were going through that list of five, I could hear your intonation as you went through each one of those, the tone in your voice and how you did it as you went through that first one and that second one, and then how, you know, you brought in the exploring. But then I could tell when you were talking about that you know, when it's time to what was P? I forgot P again.
Parting.
When it's parting.
I that carefully. Parting.
when you got to that your voice got very deep and very slow. And I actually found myself, now it's late, we're recording late on a Wednesday evening here, but I actually found myself getting sleepy. just out of the way you changed the tone of your voice, I can see how those five stitch themselves together and how those actually create an effective sleepiness. So absolutely fantastic. David, before we wrap it up today, why don't you tell people where they can find you and how they can get a hold of you if they have questions or if they want to come find your podcast? What do we do?
Well, if it's by email, you can contact me simply Biddy Bedtime Stories. Again, Biddy Bedtime Stories @gmail.com. I'm in iTunes under Biddy the Duck Bedtime Stories, and also at my website, www.biddybedtimestories.com.
And just for y'all that are wondering, that's B-I-D as in Delta, B-I-D-D-Y instead of T's.
Yes, B-I-D-D-Y Bedtime Stories, all one word, of course, from the URL. Yeah.
Awesome. David, I'm going to be honest. This has been one of the most favorite of my interviews that I've done in quite a while. I sure appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much for being willing to talk to us a little bit about sleep.
Trey, I tell you, anytime I can talk to somebody from Texas is a great day for me.
I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for the time and the opportunity and the forum, Trey. You do a great program, and anytime you can help families like you do, man, it's a very noble thing. So thank you to you as well, sir.
I appreciate that. Well, hey, that's all that we have for this episode of the Family Podcast Network, helping you work with your tough kids and even those that aren't. Don't forget to come join Jeff and I this Friday, where we're going to have our next episode of the Real Family Guys podcast. As you know, we always like to yuck it up, have a good time. We're going to have a good topic for you this Friday. You guys have a great day and a great week. And if nothing else, we'll see you all on Friday.